Hey guys, if you are a father who would like to have a deeper relationship with your son, if you have a son that you're trying to pour into and develop, if you want to help your son see the greatness that you know he has in his life, I've got a very special event coming up June 23rd through 27th. We are going to be in Cleveland National Forest. My father's coming with me, the man who you hear me talk about all the time, who helped me become who I've become in life. We're going to be doing a father-son rite of passage event, map and compass, land navigation. I'll be teaching you how to use map and compass in the exact same place that I learned in Navy SEAL training. This is going to be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You'll have these memories for the rest of your life. If you want to find out more, you can click the link in the description below. We've only got 16 spots available, and we've already sold a few of those. You can find out more at theimpossible.life/legacynavigators.
That's impossible.
Let me tell you what I believe.
But your weakness is not your technique.
Yes! Yes!
Don't think you are. Know you are.
The Impossible Life Podcast.
I mean, you're sitting on a winning lottery ticket.
An idea that is fully formed, fully understood, that sticks.
This is the Impossible Life Podcast, because Nick and I are attempting to live impossible lives. What we know is that nothing is impossible. So instead of using impossible as an excuse to not try, we'll use the pursuit of impossible as an accelerant for greatness. If something's never been done before, that just means it's unexplored. If they tell you it's too hard, it's just waiting to be simplified. Impossible is a default label used by uncourageous people, unwilling to take a risk. The real truth is this. The solution to any impossible task starts with this question. If I had to, what would it take?
Drop down.
Okay. You're just hearing Garrett abuse me because he didn't think the mics were going, but this is episode 7, and Garrett was telling me to do push-ups. I'm looking across at a man who has his young baby doing push-ups and pull-ups before she can even walk. The man who will one day launch SEAL Fit for Babies, my co-host, the former Navy SEAL, Garrett Uncle Buck.
That's me. I don't know if I'm doing SEAL Fit for Babies, but my baby will be fit.
Man, I'll always see, now it's just a game to see how you're going to respond. And
I think the game is to see if you can shock me. Episode 5 was pretty good. I gave you a funny retort.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to. I that is the joy. Like, I have this sense of like childlike.
If you don't get a response, if you don't get a response out of me, that's basically me saying that wasn't very good or that wasn't very.
You know what? I don't comply with that at all because I know you think I'm hilarious. Anyways, so this is, as you may be able to tell, a little bit of a random episode.
Yes,
not giving you guys too much of the insights into how we plan everything out, but we do go into in-depth in our preparation.
I don't even know what we're going to talk about.
Yes, and that is actually true.
Hopefully Nick does.
I do have a great idea of what we're going to talk about, but you don't, which is super fun. So what we thought would be a great idea, we've now done 6 episodes, cover a lot of different topics. Every time Garrett says something, I have more questions. And so I just thought, hey, why don't we do some follow-up questions and just let Garrett be Garrett and go into some of these episodes. So there will be a lot of different things in here. So I'm just going to launch into some questions and we're going to go with it.
I love questions.
Awesome. Okay, so very first question, and this is one that I think I know the answer to, but I'm really curious to hear from you. What's better, The Office or Parks and Rec?
Parks and Rec for sure.
Really?
Yes. I can't. Well, part of that is because I've watched Parks and Rec so many times, and my wife loves Parks and Rec also. So if there are any people out there that love Parks and Rec, one, please comment on our Instagram, and I would love to make, you know, John Ralphio or Jeremy Jam jokes with you, because I want to make those jokes all the time, and few people get the references. But sure, yeah, Parks and Rec all the way. I didn't think we were going to start right away with that type of question, so hit me with something else.
Well, that actually was not the first question I was going to ask, but after you mocked my introductions, I was like, oh, you want a surprise? I got a surprise for you, fella. So that's your fault. Anyways, okay, so this one, actually, I'm very curious to hear. So a few podcasts ago, you dispelled the myth of grind it out. Mm-hmm. Those people that say, like, I'll outwork anybody, and that's my formula for success. And you said, and I'm paraphrasing, that people that have grinded out or all outwork people don't really know what makes them successful. And you talked about Garrett's, is it success formula or winning formula?
Winning philosophy.
Yeah, you're Garrett's winning philosophy.
Yeah, so the winning philosophy is a question I start with people that I coach, or even often just like when I'm getting to know someone over coffee or lunch, I'll ask them that question. And I help them, if I ask you what your winning philosophy is, you're just going to look at me. I help them understand what winning philosophy is. And the example I use of most people when I say, like, so tell me what your winning philosophy is. And what I mean by that is, you know, some people will say, and this is not my winning philosophy, nor do I think it's a great winning philosophy, but some people will say, well, I just got to grind it out. Or, you know, I'm going to be the hardest worker in the room and no one's going to outwork me and I'll do whatever it takes. Like, that is some people's winning philosophy. What I also say, like, that's not my winning philosophy. I don't think that's a great winning philosophy. But in that context, now that you understand what one is, tell me what yours is. So that's what a winning philosophy is, or at least that's an example of one. But on this particular philosophy, winning philosophy of grind it out, I can tell you that there were a lot of guys who showed up to Buds with that thought process, like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, I'm never going to quit and I'll just push as hard as I can and I can make it. That works until it doesn't. You're the hardest worker in the room until somebody shows up that works harder than you. Mm. And there will always be someone that's more talented. You don't want to say, like, oh, my winning philosophy is I succeed because I have a high IQ. Well, then you're only going to succeed around people that have a lower IQ than you. So don't put yourself in a position of, like, I only succeed by working harder than everyone. Mm-hmm. That also, a lot of people would tell you, they're also working really hard so they can have freedom in their life. Right. That's what most people's purpose is to create freedom for their life.
Yeah.
And being the hardest worker in the room does not take you towards having freedom, right? Because now you're creating a life that revolves around you just giving up all of your time. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly not my winning philosophy. And I've said this before. I think I said it on our podcast, that if your winning philosophy is that, if your winning philosophy is, like, I am the hardest worker, then really what I would tell you is that you don't know what the specific unique things about you are that make you great. You don't really know what your winning edge is, what your winning philosophy is. You just think you can work hard. Everybody that's successful works hard, right? So you need something on top of that.
So what is your on top of that then?
Yeah, so for me, it's never, like, I always wanted to work smart. Mm-hmm. Pastor Keith, I heard him say when I was very young, I think I heard him say this even before he started the church, was that if you want to make the most money in life, you need to get paid for the way that you think. Mm. That, along with, you know, we've kind of talked about some of my defining moments and things like the Matrix, understanding, like, oh, if I can think better, if I know how to frame problems correctly, frame life correctly, that's going to make me successful. That's when I can do things really well. So my winning philosophy is that I'm great at figuring it out. I'm great at dealing with chaos. I have emotional control in my life. A lot of the, like, I'm very good at dealing with the uncontrollables. I focus on the controllables. I'm good at dealing with the uncontrollables. I'm good at solving problems. Being a problem solver is an essential piece of an entrepreneur. I don't think I'm the best person in the world at solving problems, but I'm good at them. And so that's all you need to be, because you don't compete against everyone in the world at everything at one time. Mm-hmm. I find how to win by, I know the things that I'm good at, and then I go find a lane in business where I can do all of these things. And I'm not saying, well, I'm the hardest worker. I'm going to win here. I'm going to win in this area because I work harder than everyone. Because then you'll only win until someone who works harder than you shows up. So
and that's a really,
So to answer the question more clearly, Garrett's winning philosophy is strategy,
right? And
which works well with the fact that if you know what Gallup StrengthsFinder are, my number one strength is strategic,
right? Strategery. Give me an example of where you take your, and, well, no, actually, before you even do that, how did you figure out what you were good at? Because I think my personal experience of this is that it's hard to identify your strengths because they come so naturally to you that you just assume everyone else
can
do those.
Sure. Yeah. I would tell you one of my other natural strengths is risk taking, right? Not everyone is prone to take risks, but I also had lessons and defining moments earlier in my life that helped me identify that risk is a part of life. And the avoidance of risk will keep you from experiencing life. And so where people would call me crazy when I was 15 years old because I was trying to jump off of a 20-foot garage and see if my ankles would break or not, that's what people saw me doing.
Was this the parkour thing?
Yes. Okay. But what I experienced was it took me 4 years to get to that point, constantly practice, constantly improving myself, figuring out how can I overcome this risk that everyone else is afraid to deal with, of, you know, and again, this is what I was doing in my teenage years. So not, not like the most purposeful thing, but I was trying to raise the bar on how high of a building can I jump off of. Sounds silly, and other people say that's stupid or crazy or dumb, but I had a, like, I was intending to do something. My plan was to see really how far I could take this, really how far I could push myself. So anyways, bringing that back, for me, I was always someone who said, I want to be good at taking risk. Like, and I think risk is an important part of all of our lives. If you avoid risk, you're avoiding opportunity. So being a good risk taker and getting comfortable with not just taking risks, because you don't want to just be a risk taker. You want to be someone that's good at assessing risks. Mm-hmm. But if you've never taken risk, you'll never be good at assessing them. So,
yeah. So you sparked four more questions while we did that. And it was about something completely different. So I remember when we were just kind of, we've been talking about all sorts of random stuff, and you've done, like, in the first episode, I talk about what you do now, but I don't think, not everybody knows that you've done a lot of random stuff. And you once said to me, you were one of the, did you say top five parkour people in the world?
Early on, like 2013, 2014 timeframe. There was a season of parkour before everyone, before it was at, well, you want to know how early it was? This is before parkour was ever on YouTube. Cause I remember, like, by the time everyone knew what that term was, by the time everyone knew what parkour was, what they liked about parkour is going on YouTube and seeing fail videos of people doing parkour. When I started doing parkour, people didn't call it parkour. Nobody had ever heard of it or seen it. I saw this one documentary, about Sebastian. His name's Sebastian Foucon. I'm surprised I can remember that. It's like over 10 years ago. It's a TLC documentary about Sebastian Foucon, who's one of, probably, I think he's the originator of parkour, and it comes from his father had, was in the French military. Anyways, there's a long story there, but it's about the efficient flow of movement. Huh. And I loved that.
Yeah.
And there was so much to explore there. So to answer your question, yes, there was a season of parkour in the early years where I was one of the best at the sport, and I was doing things that nobody else could do for a time. And what was so cool, just like every sport. And I feel, you know, that's my, there's no Hall of Fame. There's no honor roll. Like, it's just, it's a significant moment to me that I got to be a part of developing that sport. But just like all sports in their early years, like 2 years later, like guys after 6 months were better than I was after 5 years, because the sport just progressed at an insane level. And I see guys, I you know, every once in a while, every year or so, I'll go check in on the sport and see what guys at the front are doing. And it just blows me away.
Yeah. My favorite videos to watch on TikTok are parkour videos. Those guys are incredible.
So, well, you know, what's cool is that led up to me being so good at the obstacle course.
Yeah,
so
that's what I was going to say.
One of the slowest runners in our class, like Garrett's cardiovascular ability, really low. How am I the best at the obstacle course? Well, it was because I understood this efficient flow of movement.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny how that stuff all comes around. Well, taking it back to SEALs, you told a story once, and this is my next question. And this is probably the most, not terrifying, but like just crazy story I've ever heard that I can remember off the top of my head. You told me that when you go to a new SEAL team, because you guys have what? Is there six SEAL teams?
No. So on the West Coast, you have team 1, 3, 5, and 7. And on the East Coast, you have team 2, 4, 8, and 10. SEAL Team 6 is also on the West Coast, but they're different from the rest of the SEAL teams, and they're not actually called SEAL Team 6. They used to be, different story. I don't have to go down that road, but that's all the teams.
Okay, right. And the reason I asked that is because you said when guys go to new SEAL teams, the way you guys bond, and I remember when you were telling the story, I was thinking, oh, I wonder what they do to bond. Like, they go kill something or, you know, whatever. And you're like, yeah, we wait till midnight. You guys meet up and you fight.
Well, no, it wasn't.
Am I remembering this wrong?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that's quite correct. But some of my personal experience, and I can't account for every team, but some of my personal experience on the team, and more than bonding at a level of, like, you know, camaraderie, it was more of bonding at a sense of humility and a sense of commitment to the team over self. And what's great about this experience where everyone fights is instead of, you know, trying to show how tough you are, the point is everyone fights till they lose. And so you may be the toughest, you may be tougher than every single person in the platoon, right? But you're not tougher than the entire platoon. So you bet you, like, there was a guy, not in my platoon, different person, who's a Golden Gloves boxer. I remember him going through this experience. He knocked out quite a few people, and then eventually he got tired and got knocked out. He had never been knocked out by anybody in the Navy until that point. Right, but everybody went through that experience.
Okay, so you're talking about this the same way I would talk about going to In-N-Out to get a burger. and this, so describe this to me in a little bit more detail, because you're like, oh yeah, just people getting knocked out. Dude, that doesn't happen for a lot of people. I mean, sure. I just want to remind you.
If you've never been in a fist fight, you're missing out on a part of life. I'm not saying that that's a positive experience, but it is an experience that you should have.
Oh, man.
And it doesn't have to be, you don't have to go fight some bum at 7-Eleven. Just put on some boxing gloves with a brother the same weight and size as you and tee it up.
And what lesson in life would you say they're going to get from that?
You're going to learn the lesson of overcoming difficulty. You're going to learn the lesson of, you know, I thought I was really tough 30 seconds ago. Because if you do this, if you go in the backyard and fight, by the time, you know, you're going to think about it, you're going to prepare, then you're going to be in your corner of the yard, standing in the grass, thinking about, all right, I got this, I'm so tough, all these things. And then you're going to get popped in the mouth and you're going to feel a lot differently. And you're going to be exposed to how, if you've never been in a fight before, you're a horrible fighter.
Right.
You're going to get exposed to like, man, I actually know nothing about this. That exposed me to how weak I really am. And it's not that the goal is just to feel weak, but you do need to be aware of your weaknesses.
Okay, so I'm still not done with this Navy SEAL Fight Club because I'm trying to picture this.
I'm good to tell stories and all that, but I also want to focus on things that people can learn from.
Okay, all right, whatever, man. Well, that takes away like 95% of my
questions.
I just
took all the air out of Nick's balloon.
I mean, I had so many random questions, but okay. So actually, this is actually a really interesting question to me. So if you, obviously you've been a Navy SEAL and you've talked about, sometimes you describe yourself, you sound, if I'm being honest, geeky when you were younger. So my question is, like, if you weren't a Navy SEAL, what do you think you would have been?
Good question. You know, honestly, I haven't really ever spent a lot of time thinking about that. If I hadn't gone straight into the military, the little that I have thought about this is I imagine that my life would be similar to what my father's had been. Which for my father, he started his first business while he was still in high school, a landscaping company, and, you know, just went from there and sold that business, started another business, went into another business. I imagine that's what I would have done, you know, done a small, you know, small startup business. Like even some of the young guys that we know, they got their own business of painting or things like that. That's probably what I would have done. There's so many great lessons in just, you know, even in a small area, just taking dominion of what's in front of you. Exodus 4:2, what's in your hand? What abilities do I have? And what can I do with them now? And then grow that way.
Yeah. Okay. No, okay. That was interesting. I was curious to hear how you would answer that. Okay. So while we're keeping beneficial questions and getting rid of all the ones I actually wanted to ask.
Well, I'm not saying that you can't ask some random questions, but like, let's just not spend all our time there.
I do want to hear whenever we turn these mics off about what those fights were like, because I still want to know about the logistics of it. Like, was it more sort of battlefield style or was it one-on-one, like, you know, MMA style? So,
the lust that you're hearing Nick have for this story exposes the fact that Nick needs to be in a fight.
Man, we're about the same size. I definitely don't want you to be the guy that I go in the back with for the boxing gloves. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe we will. Anyways, that'll be another podcast. You can hear me get knocked out. It'll be fun. So here's a question that I'm very curious to hear about. Besides me, who's the most impressive person you've met? And that's actually a serious question. The besides me part was, of course, a joke.
Oh,
but
man.
I'm curious.
The most impressive person I've met. Wow.
And obviously this is going to be based on what you value as impressive in a person.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you know, I don't want to say any specific one person, but there's a lot of people that have been impressive to me in a lot of different ways. And so let me talk about some of the most impressive traits in people to me. One of the most impressive traits I see in people is the desire to continually learn. People that, you know, in their 50s say, you know, I'm going to learn how to play the piano. Like, that impresses me. You know, because a lot of people say, well, I know what I know at this point. Don't need to learn any new skills. Like, that impresses me. What impresses me is people who truly live selflessly. That's an extremely impressive trait. Another trait that is ambitious to me that I admire in others is some of the resiliency that we've talked about in podcasts before. People who know more than anything, this is what I'm put on this earth to do, and nothing can take me away from that. Like, those are people who inspire me. Like, never met him, obviously. but Sir Edmund Hillary, first man to climb Mount Everest, I think about the fact that nobody knew, like, we didn't know this was possible. Mm-hmm. I used Edmund Hillary to reframe how I felt about Buds. Like, as hard as Buds is, there's a couple thousand people that have done it before. Yeah. Can't be that hard, right? That's what I said to myself. Edmund Hillary is looking at this mountain. I don't know if, like, it is within human potential to climb this mountain, yeah, but we'll see. Right. That is inspirational to me. Yeah, those are some of the most inspiring traits. So more than just like one person, and I have my own personal heroes, but those are for me. I'd say those are the traits, that really, whenever I see those in people, that's somebody that I want to follow. That's somebody that I want to learn from. And then I would say maybe the last one, and significant, but not as significant as the others, is people who've had the patience to master a subject, to truly master a subject. Because a lot of people have got surface level depth on a million different topics. And that's me. I got surface level information on a million different things. And I'm getting really dialed in and really focused in a few areas of my life. But I have so much respect for someone who, like, has truly mastered a topic.
What do you consider surface level, though? Because you can talk about a lot of things that I think a greater depth than you maybe give yourself credit for.
Well, if you can learn it in 30 minutes on the internet, that's surface level.
Is it, though? I mean, nowadays with the way we synthesize information.
I think when you want to talk about, like, mastery of a subject,
or expert
of a subject, I think of, like, when Jordan Peterson talks, obviously it's like caviar for your ears. But when Jordan Peterson talks, what I hear is a man who has spent thousands of hours learning all these different pieces of psychology and philosophy and world history. Like, if I wanted to become Jordan Peterson, it'd take me 10 years of reading from this point to be where he is.
Yeah.
Because he has so much in his brain. And he didn't forget the stuff that he learned. But it would just, I mean, he started just by getting to the level of professor that he is, and that took a lot of work. And then just continuing to pour into his field and attaching some other bodies of information to his field and becoming great in those as well.
Yeah. Okay, so we just talked about things that you admire. You touched on a few people in there. So what do you think is the most common trait or characteristic that actually holds people back from maximizing their potential?
Oh, the number one, and it's one of the most common things. It's not really a trait. One of the most common things in this world, and certainly the biggest limiting factor on people realizing their potential, is fear.
Okay.
People live afraid of so many different things. And I would say a lot of fear, just as many conscious fears as people have, they have that many or more unconscious fears.
You know, the subconscious is something I'm kind of interested in at some point. I'd love to get somebody on here that is, like, you know, knows, is deeply like a master in psychology or whatever, and could talk to the subconscious, because I think that'd be really interesting. Just a random.
Yeah, subconscious. I mean, it's really just the part of you that you don't talk with, right? There's parts of you that are making decisions. It's codified into your memory, into your experiences, all of that. That's what the subconscious is. There's not a part of you that's not you. There's just a part of you that you don't talk with all the time.
Right. So on the lines of fear, are you able to tell the story? You almost died before, and you've talked about how that shifted your perspective. Are you able to tell that story? Because you've never actually told it. And I'm curious about
it. Yeah, I don't know if I'll tell that story on the podcast, but I will talk about that moment. You know, didn't think this is where we were going to go on this podcast, but for sure, I'll talk about this moment where I didn't. So just, we're going to fast forward past everything that leads up to this moment. And now I'm in the moment where I'm thinking, like, okay, this is it. Like, I was for sure, like, within the next few seconds, I'm going to be dead. And I remember those few seconds being a long few seconds where it wasn't my life flashing before my eyes. You know, I would tell you that after that, I spent a lot of time meditating and reflecting on my life, and it made a lot of things more real. But in those few seconds of, okay, I'm going to die, I didn't have a fear. Like, I almost had a disappointment about my life.
Huh.
Just that I thought there was more. Like, I thought there was more that I was supposed to do. And it wasn't an afraid to die moment. It was just, man, I didn't think it was over yet. Which I was both dealing with the moment later. I was both encouraged and discouraged by that. I was discouraged by letting, you know, something that I thought was going to happen to me reframe how I felt about myself. but also I was happy with the fact that, okay, like, what I was, so I wasn't afraid of anything. The only thing that disappointed me was that I didn't get to live more. Mm. But it wasn't a moment of regret.
Yeah. Man, well, I'm curious to see about
that. So one thing, there's nothing really, I think that's more of a personal experience for me, but I do want to take this moment while we're talking about that to hint on a topic that I don't know if we'll get the introduction to talk about very many times on this podcast. So I want to take advantage of this. And that what happened for me, and that was really the first big one, at least the one that I'm referencing here in my mind, and y'all don't even know the story, but that's a mortality moment where you come to grips with your mortality, where you come to grips with the fact that you're going to die one day. What happened for me in that moment, you know, and all the moments after where I thought I was going to die, was now that it brings so much reality into your life, where you realize, okay, I the time will come where my life is over, and it brings so much more clarity to what you want out of your life. And what happened to me was it kept happening over and over again, which is an even more interesting thing. But what I want to point out and what I want to talk about with the mortality moment, you don't have to be a SEAL, you don't have to go into combat to have a mortality moment. People have them all the time with health issues, with mm-hmm. car accidents, with all of those things. I have a theory that when you have those mortality moments young in life, you have a different frame of reference than people who make it to, you know, say 40 years old. And Nick is shaking his head because that's him, but I'm not talking about Nick. I just think if you've made it 40 years on this earth and you've really never come to reconcile your mortality, when it does happen mm-hmm. to you, it'll really shock you. Versus people who at a young age, and it's interesting, right? It's almost a reflection of our culture. I think in Western American culture, where it's like, gosh, I don't even want my 12-year-old to, you know, to see something on the internet where someone died. Why? Like, what are you really sheltering them from? Because I killed my first animal when I was 6 years old. That may bother some people, but for me, it gave me a very real relationship with the fact that we all die one day and our lives will end. So that should make you focus in even more on purpose. People throw their lives away one day at a time because they don't put the value on that day. Mm. But when you think you're at the end of your life, you'll give anything for another day. You'll give anything for more health. So the lesson in those mortality moments is, one, if you've had them, take advantage of them, use the opportunity to reflect on them. Man, with this season of COVID that people are in, mm-hmm. a lot of people are getting those mortality moments where they get it, they get a little sick, and they think, like, man, this could be the end.
Yeah.
You need to live your life with the preparation that you will die one day. So, on the mortality moment, just wanted to touch on that for a second. Take advantage of those mortality moments. And if you get caught off guard by a mortality moment late in life, and if you've never had that experience in your 40s or 50s or 60s even, where you're just now coming to grips with the fact that you're going to die. And by the way, you can get a mortality moment not from yourself, but if someone really close to you, like very close to you, like a spouse or your best friend or something mm-hmm. like that dies, that's also going to trigger a mortality moment for you. If you get shook by your first one late in life, just understand that that's what's happening to you. Everyone's life, everyone's experience through life is different. Just know that, like, okay, I may be 40, I may be 50 years old, and now I'm realizing that I'm going to die, and it's not in 50 years or 70 years. It could be in 10 or 20 or 5 years from now. Whatever the case is for you, just use it as a positive experience to refocus and reset and redirect and use every breath that you have. Though I used to not pray this, but ever since I had my first mortality moment, every time that I pray, I start with, thank you, Lord, for the breath in my lungs, because I know it means that you have a plan for my life. Because I went through a moment where I thought I took what I thought was my last breath. And as I'm holding my breath in these last few seconds, thinking that's the last breath I'm going to take, and then I take another one, I realize that that breath was a miracle. I realize that that breath was a gift. So that what that mortality moment is going to give you is a remembrance that every breath is a gift. Every breath has purpose. Every breath is an opportunity. So whether you find those mortality moments at 10 or 60 years old, just use it to reframe your life and know that every breath has a purpose.
Yeah, I'm thinking about a lot there. Mostly the fact that you think people that are in their 40s are close to death, but
no, it's not. That's really not. That's not the point. It's just that I think you should experience.
Yeah.
a mortality moment before you're 25 years old.
I mean, I don't even know because, to say that.
But before the way of life that we lived in today, hundreds of years ago or thousands of years ago, people were exposed to death on a way different timeline, right? So America's great at valuing life, but we've almost gone too far into the sense of like protecting people from the reality of death.
Yeah.
Or at least young people.
And that was super valuable what you just shared there. So I'm kind of switching back more into how we can bring people value. For the record, if you have questions that you would like to ask Garrett, just send them to us on Instagram or email or whatever you want to do. And we'll do another one of these episodes later down the line. And you can, you know, whether or not he'll answer, I can't speak for him, but hopefully he will. So next question then. Are you a believer in morning routines?
Oh, absolutely. Morning routines, I think, was the, well, it was more, I caught morning routine before I caught evening routine.
Okay.
I've had a solid morning routine for years. Only within the last, and I'm not going to say that it hasn't changed because my morning routine has just constantly gotten better and better, but I've practiced a morning routine for years. Within the last year and a half, I developed a good evening routine. And those evening routines are so important because they set you up for the morning routine. Like my morning routine is, so this is going to help some people. People ask, you know, how do you get up so early? Because I get up between 4 and 4:30 in the morning. And the way that I help people reframe their own life is like, if you have to speak tomorrow or you have like some presentation or whatever, you know, wherever you're at in life, like what would be a really big deal for you and make that tomorrow? If you'll get up early, probably before the alarm that day, you've got maybe even some anxiety, like I cannot oversleep tomorrow because I have to get up and do this and this and this and this and this. Well, I frame every day that way. I just take the anxiety piece out of it. I write down in my nightly journal the first 10 minutes of tomorrow.
Huh.
And it's typically the same. But I know what I'm doing in the first, like every minute. The first minute one, minute two, minute three, minute four, for the first 10 minutes. And then for the next 50 minutes of that hour, I know the next 5 things that I'm going to do. And so the reason I do that is because, okay, alarm went off this morning at 4:15. By 4:16, I have to be brushing my teeth.
Huh.
Right? So instead of, because what happens is if you don't do that, at 4:15, you're like, well, I can sit here for a minute. Like, it's early. You know, I can get out of bed at 4:20 and that's still good. No, last night I said I'm getting out of bed at 4:15. And I have to get out of bed at 4:15 because this is what I have to be doing at 4:16. And this is what I have to be doing at 4:17. Right? So it's some mission planning and some purpose and intent that I put into my life. So morning routine, evening routine.
Sorry, I'm going to interrupt you. You just reminded me of something you said on a podcast way long ago that we did earlier. Way long. We've been doing this so long. This is number 7. You talked about building confidence.
Yeah.
What you just gave
is
a great example of how to build confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So please tell us everything about your morning routine and evening routine, because now I'm seeing this. This is great.
So the confidence reference that Nick is making is a reference to like, okay, if you want to start building confidence, I say that you have to build confidence in yourself. First step is not that other people believe what you say. Do you believe what you say? People need to stop lying to themselves. You don't have any confidence because you know that you won't even do what you tell yourself. So the way that you stop that is even if it's not an early time, like, okay, tomorrow I'm gonna set my alarm for 7, and at 7, I'm gonna put my feet on the ground, right? And the more you do that, you're gonna say, check, like, look at me, like, I did what I said I was going to do. And then the more you do that for a couple of weeks, and you say, you know what, I'm gonna get up at 6 tomorrow. And you'll do it because you got a 2-week track record of doing what you said, right? So that's kind of a starting point for building confidence, and confidence and discipline go together. But that's not the topic. Coming back to morning routine, I have a solid morning routine. But I still write down those first 10 minutes because it helped. I did it for a while and then stopped doing it. And I would tell you those first 10 minutes of my day were not as intentional. Like, why wouldn't I want to start my day with intentionality? So I thought like, okay, I'll write down the first 10 minutes for like a month and then I won't need to do it anymore. And I stopped doing it and I still got up at the right time, but I realized like it wasn't as good as it was before. So I went back to doing that. So I write down the first 10 minutes of my day, and those are really simple things. It's, you know, get out of bed, brush my teeth, weigh myself, a lot of those simple things you do, you know, water, take my supplements, a lot of those simple things you do in the morning. But I got them all done in 10 minutes because I got onto that when I realized, when I started trying to get the most out of every day, that those things were taking me like 25 minutes. Huh. And timelines are a big deal in the military, not just like in mission planning, but even in training and everything. It's like timelines down to the minute. Like I remember being able to like look at everything that we have to do. And I'm like, yeah, it's going to take us 3 hours and 17 minutes. Right. Like
really,
you'd like dialing it down hard, the plan. And so like I looked at my life and said, I'm taking 25 minutes in the morning to do what it only takes 10 minutes to do. You just need to throw out the wasted time. So getting back into my running routine, I do that. And then every morning it's workout for me. It's ice. It's spending time in the Word. Sorry, I got those out of order. It's Word first, then workout, ice. But I'm saying that because the way I write it down in my journal, and I'm kind of bouncing all over the place, but I'm going to get it all out there to you. I use the Ivy Lee method personally. And what I write in my journal every evening, the number one thing is morning routine. And what I write it out, workout plus ice plus Bible, I write it out the way that I've written it for a long time, even though that's not my order anymore. My order is Bible after those, reading my Bible after those first few personal hygiene things in the morning, then workout and ice. But yeah, so morning routine is those first 10 minutes, getting into my morning journal, reading my Bible, then workout and ice. And then I come back to my journal to look at my next few tasks. What I do in that journal on the first time, I have three categories in my journal. At the front, I've got an area to do like some journaling. Every day I just write at least a sentence or two, like not a lot. It's not like really belabored journaling. It's just really more like I can look back at, you know, from March 15th and I'll see a note of, you know, met up with so-and-so for coffee. And I'm like, I remember that day perfectly. Like it's an anchor point to that day. Because when I write that line, I mentally create an anchor for the day. Like I try to put down on that line or two lines, like what was the meat or significance of today? If I have a really emotional thing happen or something significant happen, I try to put that in there too. So it's really my notes to return to that day years later if I ever need to. The middle section of my book is where I do the Ivy Lee method, the five things I'm doing every day. And then I keep some notes and things on my working tasks throughout the day. And then the back of my book is a habit tracker area. A lot of this, a lot of my morning routine is kind of an evolved or in some ways diluted, some ways changed version of James Clear's journal that he uses in Atomic Habits. I took a lot of the things that I learned when I first read his book and took the parts that I like and put them into my own life. But that's what I do with my morning journal and my morning routine. Night routine for me includes that same journal. It's one of the last things I do before bed. A lot of my night routine is kind of reset. My wife actually helped me with this. Like she resets our house every night, like puts the baby toys away, finishes, like don't bring today's problems into tomorrow, right? Like prepare for the next day. And I got really good at this part in the military. Like they would teach you and they would ingrain into you in buds. It's like, well, you clean all of your gear, right? And then you prep tomorrow's gear. So like when you get up in the morning, like here's my uniform, here's my boots, here's my weapon already cleaned, here's all my stuff. Like you prepare for tomorrow. And that just makes you more effective. I don't want to wake up in the morning and put away yesterday's dishes and then try to get my clothes picked out for today. Like I do as much as I can forward as I can. In the evenings when I'm past work time, before the time where I'm going to spend time with my little girl and spend time with my wife, I use that time to prepare for the next day. So that's some of my evening routine.
Huh. No, that I think we had one of our mutual friends ask us about time management. So you've just touched on a lot of time management.
Yeah.
And so you're looking for areas of inefficiency and just
it's exactly what I'm doing. For me, like even one of the big areas of inefficiency for me that I addressed in the last 2 years was my sleep. Like I want to sleep as little as possible, but that doesn't mean I want to be unhealthy.
Right.
So for most people, they think the only way to be better rested is greater quantity of sleep. But I said, how do I get more sleep out of the same time or even less time? So my focus was on quality of sleep. Just I don't want to spend all our time talking about sleep, but I'll just give one specific example.
Well, I want to hear it, man. I'm sleeping terribly lately.
I'll give you one specific example of sleep quality. Like this one alone should open people's eyes to like, I need to rethink my sleep habits. So they did a study and it's like, how many times have you heard that? Like the study, right? Whatever. I'll go get the study, link it here so the nerds like myself can read it, because I read this study over a year ago. I'm going to have to go find it. But I remember what I learned from it. The study showed two different groups. It showed a controlled group of people who were exposed to no blue light before they went to sleep. And they showed another group who was exposed to blue light before they went to sleep. And then the third group was people that were exposed to blue light all throughout their sleep. And all that they did for this, so control group, obviously no blue light, but for the two groups that got exposed to light, what they did was they took a blue light pen, like a small pen light, just put it on the back of the knee of the test subject. And that was all the blue light exposure that it took to have an effect on them. So here's the synopsis of what they found. And, you know, the medical experts will correct me, but this is essentially the takeaway from it. From the time that you stop absorbing blue light, it is 2 hours later that your body can begin to produce melatonin. Melatonin is the sleep hormone. It regulates a lot of other things. And the release of melatonin, not the ingestion of, because you can take melatonin, but only 2 hours after you go to sleep and 2 hours after you've stopped being exposed to blue light, can your body produce melatonin. And by the way, if you're taking a sleep supplement that is more than 2 milligrams of melatonin, that impacts your body's ability to create melatonin, which is a hormone, by the way, not something you want to mess around with. But anyways, let me just fast forward. The point is, if you stare at your phone until you go to sleep, because I can nerd out and just talk about the study for a while. If you stare at your phone until you go to sleep, you're not going to start getting quality sleep until 2 hours after you've stopped looking at your phone. So what I did was my wife and I created a process where it's better for our relationship and it's better for our health that we put our phones down in the evening. Like I set my alarm, do all my things, look at my calendar. It's why, you know, if for those of you who are my friends, when you're texting me at 8:30 and not getting a text back, that's why. Because I've already put my phone down for the evening. I won't look at it again until after I finish most of my morning routine in the morning. But by putting that phone down early, what I get is when I go to sleep, I start getting quality sleep. You can sleep for 8 hours, look at your phone until you go to sleep, and you only got 6 hours of sleep. Like, you may think like, oh man, but how is it that big of a difference? You just wasted 2 hours. So when I read that study, I'm like, I don't want to waste time. I want to sleep as little as possible, but I want to get quality sleep. So, and even backing up one more level, the conversation that we were having here was on about efficiency. I looked at, and I continue to look at every area of my life. Well, where can I get more out of a moment, essentially? Mm. Where can I get more out of this period of time? Where can I get more out of a day, out of a week, out of a month, essentially? And I just keep getting, or as Bruce Lee says it, don't focus on removing everything that's not essential. And so that's what I've been doing. Any of the things that aren't essential to my life, I'm trying to throw them away.
Any specific examples of things that you've thrown away?
It's the small things. Like, I don't need to look at, for example, I don't need to look at my phone for the last hour of the day. Like, it's not a have to. It does not support my mission. My mission is to be my absolute best. And to do that, I'm going to need to not waste any time and be at my most efficient, most effective self for the majority of that time. And looking at my phone for the last hour of the day doesn't support that. It destroys the first 2 hours of my sleep, takes away from my time with my wife. Like, I looked at that and said, this is a could do. That's a really bad thing to do. Don't do it anymore. Remove the things from your life that don't support what you want.
Man, that's a great lesson. I'm going to wrap with one question that I'm going to steal from one of my favorite podcasters, which is Tim Ferriss, and he asked this of his guests. So I'm curious to hear how you're going to answer this.
Oh, boy.
The question is, if you had a billboard that was hypothetically going to be out there for every single person in the world to see when they're driving by this imaginary road that everybody in the world goes on, what would you put on that billboard?
Oh, first, I'll just tell you the first thing that comes to mind. I could think of a lot of things to put on a billboard. First thing that comes to mind is I'm thinking of so many things now, but I'm just going to say what was the first thing. First thing that came to my mind is, it's not about you.
Well, there you go.
Most people make their life about them. They make everything about them. And when you make everything about you, everything is hard and nothing is very fun. Try it, like, make your birthday about you. See how much people like you, right? Mm. Instead, make your birthday about everybody else and everyone will love coming to your birthday. If you're someone who's like, why does nobody love hanging out with me on my birthday? Maybe because you're someone who spends all of your time making everything about you. Don't make any of your life about you and your life will be wonderful and celebrated. Make your life all about you and your life will be miserable and painful and frustrating.
Well, Man, I actually really enjoyed that. Considering we were completely unscripted and I just asked you a bunch of random questions, the efficiency thing has me.
I kind of went too long on some of them.
That's okay. I mean, we can let the people decide, but I enjoyed it.
Was that your last question? Or are we going to end with that?
No, that is.
I'm like excited to answer questions now.
The billboard. Yeah, the billboard was the last question.
Okay, cool. Well, I guess that's the last question.
Dude, you seem upset. Is there something? Is there a question you'd like to answer?
No, there wasn't. I just feel like we're just getting started.
We are just getting started, but I have a conference call in 10 minutes.
Alrighty.
See you guys. Thank you very much for listening, guys. Remember to share, like, subscribe. If you think that this would be something that someone would enjoy, please send it to them. We appreciate it all. If you want to get in touch, you can follow us on Instagram at The Impossible Life. You'll find us on there. You can also email at impossiblelifepodcast@gmail.com. If you have any questions, if you want to get in touch and find out about Garrett's personal or business coaching, that's the way to do it. Thank you again for listening. Go out there, think better, and live the impossible. See you again soon. Long before ice baths were a thing, Garrett was doing them in the SEAL teams. Now we do them as part of our daily morning routine to make us better. We are very pleased to have partnered with Freedom Plunge. Freedom Plunge is on a mission to bring cold exposure to everyone. They believe that cold plunges should be affordable, easy to use, and represent the customer themselves. Cold plunges shouldn't cost a fortune, and these ones don't. Garrett and I both use our Freedom Cold Plunge every single day. It's customized. You can put whatever you want on them. For us, we have our Impossible Life logos. And here's the best part. Just for listening to this podcast, you can go to freedomplunge.com, use the discount code IMPOSSIBLE, and save $500 off any Freedom Plunge. These things are half the price of the ones that you see on the internet, plus you're going to save an additional $500 with code IMPOSSIBLE. Go to freedomplunge.com and get yourself one now. You will not regret it.